Today is Wednesday, January the 15th. Welcome to the award-winning Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key. Many of us are reminded of the importance of warmth and comfort. Unfortunately, not everyone has access to proper winter clothing. Donating winter coats helps those in need stay warm during the colder months. By donating your gently used or new winter coats, you contribute to the community support initiatives that aim to keep vulnerable populations safe and warm during the harsh winter conditions. Contact local charities and organizations that accept clothing donations. You can use search engines by typing in the keywords such as winter coat donation near me, or you can type in coat drive near me for more targeted results. Big Tech has been collecting and aggregating your personal data. Do you know how big tech companies and our government are using your personal data? We have been bringing computer news, hardware and software reviews, guest interviews, and news of user group meetings for the past 40-plus years. The Personal Computer Show is a 3-time winner of the prestigious National Computer Press Awards. Our only advocacies are consumerism and the First Amendment. I welcome you, the listeners, to provide feedback as to what you want to hear. Address your suggestions to Hank at pcradioshow.org. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network, prn.live. That's prn.live, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.live on the Internet. You can leave us a message with your questions or comment at hank@pcradioshow.org. Mark Zuckerberg tells Joe Rogan Biden aides try to censor anyone arguing against the vaccine. Mark Zuckerberg claimed that Biden officials would scream and curse at his executives at Meta over censoring Facebook users as he continues to take on a more MAGA-friendly persona following Donald Trump's win. Zuckerberg said the administration basically pushed us and said anything that says that vaccines might have side effects, you basically need to take down. And I was just like, we're not going to do that. We're clearly not going to do that.
There's a lot of like hypercritical people that are conspiracy theorists and think that everybody's a part of some cabal to control them. I want you to understand that whether it's YouTube or all these – whatever place that you think is doing something that's awful, it's good that you speak because this is how things get changed and this is how people find out that people are upset about content moderation and censorship. But moderating at scale is insane.
Yeah.
It's insane.
Yeah.
What we were talking the other day about the number of videos that go up every hour on YouTube, and it's bananas. It's bananas. That's like – to try to get a human being that is reasonable, logical, and objective that's going to analyze every video, it's virtually impossible. It's not possible. So you've got to use a bunch of tools. You're going to get a bunch of things wrong.
Yep.
And you have also people reporting things. And how much is that going to affect things? You could have mass reporting because you have bad actors. You have some corporation that decides we're going to attack this video because it's bad press. Get it taken down.
Mm-hmm.
There's so much going on. Just – I want to put that in people's heads before we go on. Like, understand the kind of numbers that we're talking about here. Now understand you have the pandemic, and then you have the administration that's doing something where I think they crossed the line, where it gets really weird, where they're saying what you were saying. They were trying to get you to take down vaccine side effects, which is just crazy.
Yeah, so, I mean, like you're saying, I mean, this is – it's so complicated, this system, that I could spend every minute of all of my time doing this and not actually focused on building any of the things that we're trying to do, AI, glasses, like the future of social media, all that stuff. So I get involved in this stuff, but in general, we have a policy team. There are people who I trust. There, the people who are kind of working on this on a day-to-day basis. And the interactions that that I was just referring to, I mean, a lot of this is documented. I mean, because – you know, Jim Jordan and the House had this whole investigation and committee into the kind of government censorship around stuff like this. And we produced all these documents and it's all in the public domain. I mean, basically, these people from the Biden administration would call up our team and like scream at them and curse. And it's like these documents are, it's all kind of out there.
Oh, did you record any of those phone calls?
I don't think we, but I think.
I want to listen.
I mean, there are emails. the emails are published. It's all kind of out there. And they're like, and basically it just got to this point where we were like, no, we're not gonna take down things that are true. That's ridiculous. They wanted us to take down this meme of Leonardo DiCaprio looking at a TV talking about how 10 years from now or something, you know, you're going to see an ad that says, okay, if you took a COVID vaccine, you're eligible for, you know, like for this kind of payment, like this mm-hmm. sort of like class action lawsuit type meme. And they're like, no, you have to take that down. And we just said, no, we're not going to take down humor and satire. We're not going to take down things that are true. And then at some point, I guess, I don't know, it flipped a bit. I mean, Biden, when he gave some statement at some point, I don't know if it was a press conference or to some journalists, where he basically was like, these guys are killing people. And I don't know, then like all these different agencies and branches of government basically just like started investigating and coming after our company. It was brutal. It was brutal.
Wow.
Microsoft bets on Copilot Plus, PCs, and Windows 11, with no Windows 12 on the horizon. Microsoft is focused on AI-powered Windows 11 and Copilot Plus PCs for the foreseeable future. On October 14th of this year, Windows 10's deprecation date, pushing users towards Windows 11 or newer PCs. At the CES 2025 forum, it is reported that Microsoft is not releasing the next generation of Windows, which many of us assume will be called Windows 12, just yet. Instead, Microsoft is pushing ahead with its vision of AI-powered PCs, which it calls Copilot Plus PCs, and intends to continue to integrate artificial intelligence into Windows 11. Microsoft, eager to capitalize on AI buzz, is getting big on tools like ChatGPT and its own AI assistant, Copilot, which is accessible directly from the taskbar, becoming an everyday part of our digital work and personal lives. There is also an emphasis on future versions of Windows 11 because Windows 10 is nearing its end of support date, which is on October the 14th, 2025. Youssef Mehdi, Microsoft's Executive Vice President and Consumer Chief Marketing Officer, reinforced this at the recent CES 2025, stating that Windows 10 is still on track to be deprecated on this date. That's a fancy way of saying all support for Windows 10 stops. When October the 14th rolls around, Microsoft will stop releasing regular updates, including security updates for Windows 10 after that. You'll either have to buy a newer Windows 11 PC or pay for extra security updates for a limited time, and it's clear Microsoft would rather all Windows 10 users upgrade to Windows 11. At present, Windows 10 installations represent over 60% of current installations. So it looks like Windows 12 won't be coming in the foreseeable future, as Microsoft is focusing on getting its users to upgrade to Windows 11. It's also focusing on winning over people with Copilot Plus PCs, offering a pretty bold vision of what these devices will be capable of and how much they'll change and how we interact with our PCs. Windows Latest points out that Windows 11 came out during the pandemic when people were buying new PCs and Microsoft saw an opportunity for a PC sales push, and that it'll wait for another opportunity like this to launch Windows 12, though hopefully not another global pandemic. Some people are perhaps disappointed that we're not getting a bold new operating system or are reluctant to move on from Windows 10, which is still very much Microsoft's most popular operating system. Microsoft has a long way to go to actually convincing people that its AI improvements are worth people's time and expense. As Microsoft is experimenting the integration of AI-powered software and tools into Windows 11, there's potential for artificial intelligence to redefine how we interact with PCs. However, experiments come with risk, and Microsoft would be remiss not to learn from this venture, and it should pay close attention to feedback from its users. If its involvement with AI doesn't succeed, or at least not immediately, Microsoft would be wise to consider designing Windows 12 with an option to operate without heavy AI integration. Using Windows 12 as a clean break should its AI gamble not pay off. Microsoft doesn't appear to be distracted with making Windows 12, whilst there's still a lot of work to be done with Windows 11 to make it more popular, especially as there will soon be a lot of Windows 10 users looking to upgrade. Microsoft, I hope that you are still paying attention that with many of these Windows 10 users, they are using vertical applications, and AI is not the foremost factor in the use of the machine. You should make accommodations for these users. Honey's Deer Hunting Browser Extension accused of ripping off customers and YouTubers. PayPal Honey is a suite of online shopping tools designed to help users save money while shopping online. It includes a browser extension that automatically finds and applies coupon codes at checkout with just a single click. Originally known as Honey Science Corporation, it was founded in 2012 and later acquired by PayPal in 2020 for approximately $4 billion. The primary function of PayPal's Honey is to automatically search for and apply coupon codes during the checkout process, ensuring users get the best possible discounts. In addition to coupons, PayPal Honey offers cashback options and rewards for purchases made at participating retailers. Honey works with over 30,000 online retailers, making it a versatile tool for shoppers looking for deals. PayPal Honey is available as a free browser extension and also has a mobile app allowing users to access its features on various devices. This makes it easy for shoppers to save money whether they are using a desktop or mobile device. PayPal was hit with a proposed class action for allegedly pocketing sales commission belonging to YouTube influencers for promoting products and services in their content. The claim accuses PayPal of replacing affiliate links, indicating that the content creators drove traffic to purchases with links crediting Honey, a browser extension owned by PayPal that applies coupon codes on e-commerce websites. The PayPal Honey browser extension is, in theory, a handy way to find better deals on products while you're shopping online. But in a recently video published, YouTuber Megalag claims the extension is a scam and that Honey has been stealing money from influencers, including the very ones they paid to promote their product. Honey works by popping up an offer to find coupon codes for you while you're checking out in an online shop. But as Megalag notes, it frequently fails to find a code or offers a Honey-branded one, even if a simple internet search will cover something better. The Honey website pitches that it will find every working promo code on the internet. But according to the Megalag's video, ignoring better deals is a feature of Honey's partnerships with its retail clients. Megalag also says Honey will hijack affiliate revenue from influencers. According to Megalag, if you click on an affiliate link from an influencer, Honey will then swap in its own tracking link when you interact with its deal pop up at checkout. That's regardless of whether Honey found you a coupon or not, and it results in Honey getting the credit for the sale, rather than the YouTuber or website whose link led you there. Megalag isn't the first to make such claims. Legal action has been initiated by several content creators, including prominent YouTuber Devin Stone, known as Legal Eagle, and others like Sam Denby, Wendover Productions, and Ali Spagnola. The lawsuit was filed in California on December the 29th of last year. PayPal VP of Corporate Communications Josh Crisco said in an email that Honey follows industry rules and practices, including last-click attribution. Honey is free to use and provide millions of shoppers with additional savings on their purchases whenever possible. Honey helps merchants reduce cart abandonment and comparison shopping while increasing sales conversion. Such theft can occur even when Honey tells a shopper no coupons are available, but they buy the product anyway, the lawsuit claimed. PayPal also offers Honey Gold, a system that awards consumers PayPal rewards points redeemable for gift cards, the lawsuit noted. However, when a shopper gets points worth a small amount, even less than a dollar from a purchase, PayPal may snatch a $35 commission that should have gone to the creator, the lawsuit alleged. While the lawsuit does not allege online shoppers were defrauded, the practices PayPal is alleged to have engaged in could undermine the foundations of online shopping, said Josh Sanford, a lawyer for the plaintiffs. PayPal has grown the world of e-commerce, which is great for everyone, Sanford said. However, he said if the allegations are borne out as true, they're going to have made e-commerce harder because it makes vendors and consumers less able to trust each other and less confident that they understand the terms of their transaction. Well, you probably heard the term generative artificial intelligence, or generative AI, but there's another term that is being talked about, and that is AGI. Well, in leaked documents, OpenAI has a very clear definition of AGI, and OpenAI and Microsoft define AGI as AI software that can generate $100 billion in profit. I knew it would get down to money somewhere. We finally have a real definition of the elusive AGI. OpenAI and Microsoft have a secret definition for AGI, an acronym for Artificial General Intelligence, or any system that can outperform humans at most tasks. According to leaked documents obtained by The Information, the two companies came to agree in 2023 that AGI will be achieved once OpenAI has developed an AI system that can generate at least $100 billion in profits. There has long been debate in the AI community about what AGI really means, or whether computers will ever be good enough to outperform humans at most tasks and wipe out major swaths of the economy. The term artificial intelligence itself is something of a misnomer, because much of it is really just a prediction machine, taking in keywords and searching large amounts of data without really understanding the underlying concepts. But OpenAI has received more than $13 billion in funding from Microsoft over the years, and that money has come with a strange contractual agreement that OpenAI would stop allowing Microsoft to use any new technology it develops after AGI is achieved. OpenAI was founded as a nonprofit under the guise that it would use its influence at any AGI that is developed to create products that benefit all of humanity. The idea behind cutting off Microsoft once AGI is attained is that direct access to OpenAI intellectual property could unduly concentrate power in the tech giant. In exchange for investing billions in a nonprofit then, Microsoft's current agreement with OpenAI guarantees it's a slice of profit until it reaches a predetermined cap somewhere in the high tens of billions, and the cap is meant to ensure most profit eventually goes back to building products that benefit the entirety of humanity, supposedly. This all pie-in-the-sky speak since, again, AI is not that powerful at this point. The nonprofit structure of OpenAI has long been considered a farce, and unsurprisingly, the company announced this year intentions to pivot into a for-profit structure while maintaining its mission to benefit all of humanity, somehow, because the current nonprofit structure makes it difficult to raise more money and compete against other AI players. Consequently, The Information says Microsoft and OpenAI have been negotiating a host of changes to the arrangement that would go into place should the companies restructure. Microsoft also currently serves as OpenAI's exclusive cloud hosting provider, and OpenAI may want to end that as well as stop profit sharing and switch to simply giving Microsoft straight equity. Microsoft and OpenAI have been on diverging paths for some time now. It was reported that the latter has begun incorporating AI models developed in-house into its 365 Copilot product in order to improve cost and efficiency. It doesn't make sense for Microsoft to continue relying on OpenAI, an independent company for technology that it believes will be the backbone of its productivity software going forward. Especially with all the chaos and drama that has surrounded OpenAI, Microsoft needs its own proprietary tech to chart its own path. OpenAI, for its part, is far away from achieving $100 billion in profit on technology whose true value remains speculative, which means it would likely have to keep giving its technology to Microsoft for a long time. Not great when it looks like they are headed towards being competitors, and handing over large amounts of its revenue makes it less attractive to new investors, which it will need as it continues to burn cash. Getting rid of the cloud hosting agreement could also allow OpenAI to negotiate better hosting costs with an alternative provider. Researchers make major breakthrough in developing next-gen replacement for lithium-ion batteries. Magnesium may now be ready to enter the battery sector, thanks to experts at Canada's University of Waterloo. An effective cathode is the next missing element on Waterloo's list to take the tech to the next level, according to a school news release. The experts stated that magnesium battery findings were first shared in a research paper in 2000, but the element couldn't provide the same voltage as lithium, and the latter metal became the prominent one used in battery chemistry. Scientists worldwide continue to pursue batteries that use cheaper materials, are safe, and are high-performing. Potassium, sodium, and iron are among elements being tinkered with in the labs. Magnesium is more abundant and less expensive than lithium. Its ions have double the electrons compared to lithium, potentially providing for more energy density or storage capacity per pound, according to Waterloo and government experts at the Argonne National Laboratory. Argonne added slow charge times and technical challenges during cycling to the list of cons. For its part, lithium packs are reliable, cleaner energy sources, especially when replacing fossil-burning cars. But it's a tough-to-harvest element with an environmental cost documented by Euronews, in which water use and contamination are among concerns highlighted as fallout from the colorful brine pits often associated with lithium extraction sites. Magnesium batteries are potentially advantageous because they have a more robust supply chain and are more sustainable to engineer, and raw material costs may be less than the state-of-art lithium-ion batteries. And now it seems Waterloo team may have solved the voltage conundrum with an electrolyte that enables a highly efficient magnesium anode. The coin cell prototype registered 3 volts, a big increase from the less than 1 volt mark previously reached. For reference, an AA battery provides a 1.5 volts, according to Waterloo. The electrolyte we develop allows us to deposit magnesium foils with extremely high efficiency, and it is stable to a higher voltage than successfully tested before. Postdoctoral fellow Chang Li said in the lab summary, "All we need now is the right cathode to bring it all together." When batteries cycle, ions move between the anode and cathode through the electrolyte. Waterloo's version is non-corrosive and non-flammable, while addresses safety concerns associated with lithium packs. While rare, lithium battery fires can be explosive and calamitous, the National Fire Prevention Association noted in a fact sheet. Addressing battery costs and safety is important as our transportation system continues to transition to electric rides. The International Energy Agency reported that nearly one-fifth of the vehicles sold in 2023 were electric vehicles, a 35% increase from the prior year. Each EV that replaces a gas guzzler prevents thousands of pounds of planet-warming air pollution a year. That's according to the government's data. A one-time tax break of up to $7,500 and recurring fuel savings worth around $1,500 a year, are big boons for motorists to switch. The Waterloo team has some work to do before magnesium packs can reliably power EVs. But they think their findings are scalable. Presenting the IT Pro Series with Benjamin Rockwell.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time to get down to business. This is where we talk about computers, the workplace, and so much more. We all have computers sitting in front of us if we are dealing in the workplace, most of us at least. Yes, there are people who don't touch computers but a few times a day. What I'm going to relate to you is information in regards to if you own a company, if you are a user, a computer user in a company, and that is all about the simple math of doing upgrades to your computers. And this is going to be simple math, and I'm going to do calculations for you all the way along through here. And we hear about Moore's Law. Moore's Law is a nice simple law that says computers double in speed and capacity every 2 years. And that is exciting. And it doesn't always serve for great money decisions, but it does serve as a good guideline for us to start thinking about when do we upgrade computers. Now, if you're a company owner, this is something that you should be really paying attention to. Even if you are just one of the end users in a company, you are utilizing a computer that's sitting right in front of you. And if it's getting old, it's long in the tooth, you're going, you know, this is crawling. I need a faster computer. I'm giving you information right now that allows you to take this information, what I'm going to talk about, to your boss and explain to them how there is cost savings for most upgrades. Now, if you have a computer that is, we'll call it 6 years old, and you have to wait an average of 5 minutes extra each day for your computer over the new one, you are cutting into the company's money. Time is money, right? We've always heard this, and the reality is, yes, it is. I want you to consider how long you wait for your computer. How long does it take to boot? Does it take 5 minutes? Does it take 3 minutes? Maybe it takes 1 minute. You've got an updated computer that's running a solid state drive and it's got a lot of different things along there. Great. If it's 1 minute boot time, great. But if it's getting up there to the 3 minutes, 5 minutes, then let's start attaching numbers to this. So let's attach just a matter of a couple of minutes there for your computer boot time. And loading Word, that may be a matter of 30 seconds. It may be a matter of 5 seconds. Loading up Chrome, whatever your browser is, you may be utilizing Microsoft Edge. It doesn't matter. But it may be a matter of 15 seconds. It may be 5 seconds. Loading up your email, loading up whatever programs you're dealing with. As long as they are locally based, they're going to have some level of a lag time for the computer to go out to the hard drive, to load that computer into memory, to do all of the processing that it needs to do with the CPU and everything like that. So, I usually look at the boot time and then I triple it. I say if it's a 1 minute boot time, then it is, all of the other things are going to fall into place behind that. If it's a 5 minute boot time, I'm really going to start questioning that computer. So I attach a simple number to this, and I look at it as 5 minutes per day. If I can save you 5 minutes per day, and this is down to a business decision. This is for business owners to translate into their employees, but we can do this personally ourselves when we're talking about our home PCs. This is all the way throughout all of this. If you can get back 5 minutes a day, how much does that restore into your productivity, your strength, your things that you're doing of what you need or what you like, whatever it is, then we start restoring some balance. We start realizing what the value is in upgrading a computer. If you make $20 an hour, that 5 minutes of computer slowdown costs you a matter of $1.66 a day. Okay, that sounds like nothing. But let's talk about in the business world. In the business world, we're using the computer 8 hours a day. I'm going to tell you, you're going to save more than 5 minutes with a brand new computer. It's all in those small little chunks of time. But let's simply talk about 5 minutes a day. 200 work days in a year by $1.66, that's about $333 a year, $1,000 in a year. Or 3 years, rather. Sorry about that. That's a lot of money. It is crazy math to say that you're going to save $300 if you purchase a computer every 2 years. But it's not crazy to note that you're saving yourself cash if you upgrade when your computer is slow. There's an easy thing to think about. If your computer is 2 years old, maybe not going to be all that great unless you are a serious power user. But if your computer is 4 years old, there's going to be a lot of time that's restored back to your day. If it's 6 years old, there's a lot of time that's going to be restored back to that day. And you just have to start doing that number calculation of how much money are you saving in a day when you upgrade the system. And there's a lot of fuzzy math that's going to have to happen beyond that. But we start having to think about, why am I dealing with a 10-year-old computer when I can do so many things so much faster? It's a low expense to the company. It's a low expense to us when we start translating it into how much we make every hour. What are you waiting for? This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. Be aware of what information you input into ChatGPT. When using ChatGPT or any other AI engine, be cautious about what information you share. Avoid inputting passwords, confidential data, proprietary information, client details, or business secrets. These inputs can potentially be revealed to third parties or used to access your accounts and steal private information. Interacting with AI chatbots like ChatGPT can be both engaging and informative. However, it's crucial to recognize their limitations and exercise caution to ensure your safety and privacy. Information you should never ask or share with AI chatbots. Personal information. It is not good to post your full name, your home address, your phone contact, your email address, or any form of identification number. You risk having your privacy invaded or falling victim to identity theft, since AI chatbots may store and process your data in ways you're unaware of. Financial details. Do not type any financial information such as account numbers, credit card information, or passwords while using a chatbot. Sharing this information puts you at risk for fraudulent scams or identity theft fraud. Medical information. Modern AI can help a person find information about general health, but it cannot and should not diagnose the disease or prescribe treatment. Chatbots also have no ability to look at your entire medical history and all the complexities of human health, which are crucial for the right medical advice. And that also applies for legal advice. Do not request any legal advice from legal bots. Legal issues are delicate and need individual handling by competent individuals. An important drawback of relying on AI for advice is that there will be misunderstandings or misinterpretations of the law. And then there's confidential work information. Avoid disclosing any trade secrets you know about your workplace or any projects that you undertake. Such data, when fed to the chatbot, means that there is a likelihood of violation of contractual privileges and corporate espionage. These are trends that tarnish the professional practice. And, of course, there's explicit content. Most chatbots filter any explicit stuff shared with them, so anything inappropriate may get you banned. Not just this. Also remember, the internet never forgets anything, so you never know where these may surface. AI chatbots are useful in providing information or assistance. On the other hand, they embrace serious limitations and should be used prudently. When using this personal and sensitive information, it should be ensured that it is well protected. Passports may soon become obsolete as facial recognition and smartphones take over. There are concerns about privacy and security are already being raised. Travel documents are on the brink of a technological revolution as facial recognition systems become mainstream. But some countries are finding it tricky to strike a balance between convenience and privacy, as well as security and efficiency. In the coming years, the traditional paper passport, a document that has been a cornerstone of the international travel for over a century, may soon become obsolete. In its place, facial recognition technology and smartphones are poised to become the new standard for identity verification at airports worldwide. This shift towards biometric identification is not a distant possibility, but a rapidly approaching reality. Airports in numerous countries, including Finland, Canada, the Netherlands, the United Arab Emirates, the United Kingdom, Italy, the United States, and India, are already conducting trials of passport-free travel systems. Singapore, for example, allows its residents to enter and exit the country without physical passports and is extending this convenience to departing foreign visitors. The drive to streamline the travel experience is driving this trend. At the heart of this technological shift is the concept of Digital Travel Credential, with the acronym DTC, developed by the United Nations International Civil Aviation Organization, which has the acronym ICAO. The DTC system comprises two key components: a virtual element representing the information traditionally stored in passport chips, and a physical part stored on the traveler's smartphone. These components are cryptographically linked to ensure authenticity and prevent forgery. The implementation of DTC systems varies, with some approaches still requiring travelers to carry, but not necessarily present, their physical passports, while more advanced versions aim to eliminate the need for a physical passport entirely. Early trials have shown promising results. In Finland, a small-scale DTC pilot conducted by border officials demonstrated that identity checks could be completed in just 8 seconds, with technical processing taking only 2 seconds. While the prospect of reduced airport queues is undoubtedly appealing, the transition to digital travel documents raises significant concerns. Privacy experts caution about the lack of transparency surrounding these technologies and the potential for data breaches and increased surveillance. The ICAO itself acknowledges risks such as look-alike fraud, criminal data collection, system outages, and the possibility of forced rejection in facial recognition systems. The development of verification systems by various companies worldwide adds another layer of complexity. The fact is that all of these companies develop these systems often do so in deeply proprietary manners. Another concern is who will handle the data, including who can access it, for what reasons, and how much control they have over its use. Achieving this level of precision in data management presents significant challenges. Perhaps not surprisingly, the implementation of these systems has not been without controversy. In India, the DigiYatra face recognition boarding system has faced criticism over its introduction and enrollment processes. The DigiYatra system has been operating in 24 airports around the country and may be opening up to foreign citizens in 2025. Meanwhile, the privacy and compliance issue the system has raised will only heighten as there are plans in India to roll out the identity technology to to hotels and historical monuments. NASA's Deep Space Mission Control is unattended for the first time in 6 decades as the Los Angeles wildfires rage. It was a very emotional thing. The first time in the 60 years that nobody was actually in the mission control office at Jet Propulsion Lab. The wildfires currently burning through regions of Southern California are not just visible from space, they're threatening scientists' work in space as well. NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab, also known as JPL in Pasadena, had to be evacuated on January the 8th, and it remained closed through Monday because of the encroaching Eaton fire. The research center has thus far been spared by the flames. Although the emergency disrupted some of the JPL's data processing, and according to social media posts, greatly impacted the JPL community. The Deep Space Network has managed to retain contact with all of its active spacecraft throughout the evacuation. Lori Leshin, who is the director of JPL, wrote in an X post on Friday the following. JPL is untouched by fire due to the brave dedication of our first responders, but our community has been very seriously impacted with over 150 employees of JPL who have lost their homes and many more displaced. A JPL Facebook administrator confirmed this grim situation in a comment on Sunday. Most of the staff was asked to work from home this week, and administrators started a relief fund for Caltech and JPL communities. JPL is a federally funded robotic space exploration laboratory managed by the California Institute of Technology, also known as Caltech, on behalf of NASA. It's also home to the agency's Deep Space Network, a web of giant radio antennas used to communicate with space missions. Established in the late 1950s and early 1960s, Deep Space Network currently maintains contact with the Voyager probes, the Mars rovers, and the Juno probe around Jupiter. The Space Flight Operations Center at JPL has been operational and staffed every day since 1964, according to NASA. According to the evacuation notice posted on the lab's website last Wednesday, JPL facilities, labs, and hardware are secured and protected. Deep Space Network operations normally conducted at JPL have been moved off-site to a backup operations center. In a bit of good news, the Deep Space Network team maintained contact with the spacecraft throughout the evacuation. Nicola Fox, NASA's associate administrator, said during the 245th American Astronomical Society meeting taking place this week in Maryland, reported that our incredible Deep Space Network team has gone above and beyond to ensure that not a bit of data has been lost. It was a very emotional thing. The first time in the 60 years that nobody was actually in the mission control office at JPL because they had to relocate to the emergency center. Unfortunately, the evacuation of the research center did result in some data processing disruptions, including some near real-time data information available shortly after being recorded by a space instrument, data from soil moisture, active-passive platform, which regularly measures surface soil conditions, and data from the microwave limb sounder, which measures atmospheric features twice daily. While the fact that the JPL remains undamaged is a relief to the scientific community, it remains to be seen how the lab will fare with the strengthening dry winds predicted to continue this week. Presenting Technology Chatter with Benjamin Rockwell and Marty Winston.
Marty Winston joins me now. Marty.
I have a question.
Yes?
Do you have any charge cards in your wallet?
Charge card? Like
credit
MasterCard,
card.
Visa?
Yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Now, do you have any of those charge cards in your Google wallet?
So I'm over on the other side.
Oh, you're
side
on the Apple
fence.
Side.
Yes.
Fine.
I do have a couple of those digitally. Yeah.
Yeah. See, and what happens if you want to charge, but your phone doesn't have one?
Hey,
have you lost your ability to pay?
So for me, I always have my wallet with me. So.
Oh, how redundant. This guy believes in backup.
Yes, that's of course. Thing. Yeah.
I just think it's so ironic that we spend a lot of attention on making sure we can charge with the phone.
Yeah.
And then not making sure the phone has a charge so you can charge. So.
Yeah. I mean, that is very fair.
Now, you and I have both traveled to trade shows.
Once or twice, yes.
and there was an era when you had to carry something like a car battery and an inverter and a charge adapter in order to keep your phone going, right?
I do remember those days, yes.
A lot of power banks are out there these days. Some of them have massive amounts of power. You know, you want to run the Rockettes for a month, you can do that.
Sure.
Some of them are just to keep you going on the trip. And I want to cover both because I've been looking at when I travel, and I've done more trade shows this year than usual. I don't want to have that dent in my shoulder from the strap on the bag holding the charger and everything else.
Yeah.
And it's really hard to avoid. So I look at two things in a charger.
Mm-hmm.
I look at if I'm willing to deal with the mass, the weight of the thing, is size going to be helpful? And the other way around, if I have to prioritize size, will there be enough charge?
Yeah, that's a very tricky trade-off there, yeah.
Yeah, I'd also, can I recharge it from an outlet under the seat, or do I have to recharge it from USB if my recharger needs recharging? All of that. And if I'm finicky, if you're finicky, the finicky standards held by our spouses.
Yes.
My wife wants something with her that doesn't take up the whole purse, takes up hardly any of it, that she can travel for 2 or 3 days and not have to worry about it. And I found one. It's from our friends at J5 Create.
Okay,
All right. It's their JPB 5220 USB-C Pocket Power Bank.
Okay. Now,
you can tell the battery inside of it is about the size of your thumb, maybe a little longer, like a lot of those famous lithium-ion batteries we dealt with before.
Sure.
I didn't open it up to look. It's just that kind of shape. And there's a little right angle for the Android part of the world USB-C connector on it.
Mm-hmm. All right.
So you just plug it in to the bottom of your phone. By the way, you can also use that to plug into your charger if you want, or there's a charging port on the side of it. And what you get is almost 5 amp hours of stored charge with a very beefy 20-watt PD-compatible delivery to your phone. So
okay.
It's small enough, it's light enough, and reliable enough. But it now lives in my wife's purse. It's about $30.
Yeah, this is a neat little power bank. It's as wide as I would say. I'm guessing, is that the larger phones?
It's a little wider than the phone.
Yeah, it depends on the size.
It's the length of the battery, but because it's in line with the bottom of the phone, you don't really notice that. Where you aren't likely to, where I noticed it, and you know, forgive me, not everything I do is compatible with everything else I do. The connector wasn't quite long enough to plug into the phone with my OtterBox case on the phone.
Oh, okay.
But that didn't matter. It didn't matter. So, my wife doesn't use those cases, and she gets pretty phones and plug this in the bottom and she keeps going. Part of the lesson is if you're going to travel, decide how many things you need to charge for how long and how often you're going to have a chance to recharge your recharger, the power bank. The other thing really is what works for you. You know, it comes down to size, it comes down to cost, it comes down to the power capacity, comes down to what you're recharging, and it comes down to your patience for these things. Now, getting enough capacity into something small enough, light enough, cheap enough, it helps if it charges quickly enough that you don't have to hang it on the phone for the whole trip.
Sure, definitely. Man, I'm just thinking back to the old days when I had a bag phone. Got 30 minutes of calling power out of that, maybe 4 hours of standby, something like that.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, yeah, and it was heavy. Yeah. Beat up a burglar, hit him over the head with it.
Yeah. You know, guys, if you're going to look for one, include J5 Create in your search.
Definitely. That's J5Create.com is their website, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, but they're also in Micro Center, a lot of stores, a lot of the onliners.
Sure. All right. As for now, this is Benjamin Rockwell. That's Marty Winston. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin, and thank you, Marty. Public service announcements. Computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. Log on to the club website for more information on remote meeting ID. The Brookdale Computer Users Group meets Thursday, January the 23rd. Meeting time is 6:45 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom, and their website is bcug.com. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey meets Friday, February the 7th. Meeting time is 8 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Jitsi. Website is acgnj.org. Tech Ed Connect meets Tuesday, February the 11th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. It is a hybrid meeting. The meeting is at the Scarsdale Public Library at 54 Olmsted Road in Scarsdale, New York, and online virtual meeting via Zoom. Website is wpcug.org. The King's Bite Computer Club meets Tuesday, February the 11th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at the Park Plaza Restaurant, located at 220 Cadman Plaza West in Brooklyn. Phone number is 347-278-7320 for more information or to confirm meeting. The New York Amateur Computer Club meets Thursday, February the 13th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., online virtual meeting via Zoom. Website is nyacc.org. Long Island Macintosh Users Group meets Friday, February the 14th, Valentine's Day. Meeting time is 7 p.m., online virtual meeting via Zoom, and their website is limac.org. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN, live streaming on the Internet. Podcast of the program is available on prn.live on the Internet. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to Hank at pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Michael Horowitz, Benjamin Rockwell, and Marty Winston, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station next week.